Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPT 106.5 FM, Los Angeles.
102.3 FM, Riverside.
And 105.0 AM, Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and I am Al Warren, last I heard. And Mr. Martino is making martinis.
I am, right here in the basement of the House of Mystery.
Yeah, we're not letting you out either.
Nope. Chained down here.
You're chained down there. You're chained down there, and we keep throwing amber turds down there for you. That's your munchie. What was that you had on the... You were at the store. What were you showing me? A picture of grass? You were waiting in a lineup for grass? What is that?
Well, that was the cats. That was like the cat.
So you're buying your cat grass? Like marijuana grass? Like what kind of grass?
No, he doesn't smoke it.
Oh, he just eats it.
He just eats it, yeah.
Why do you have...
At least I've never seen him smoke it.
Well, he needs help rolling, right? He doesn't have fingers. Yeah. Come on.
No.
So what's the deal with that? Like, he doesn't have grass at home? You don't let him out?
Well, he's mainly an indoor cat. We might put him in a harness soon and allow him to go around the patio or whatever. But for the most part, he is an indoor cat. And so he needs his greens.
You gotta eat the green.
Eat the green.
Yeah, you know, I can't tell you enough about eating green, what it does for me. You know, you want your cat to be like me.
Yeah, well, that's what that's what happens with the cat.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know what goes on over there. There's something going on in that house.
You don't want to know.
I don't. No. You know, scared. You get to have a warning label on the door. You know?
We do.
Yeah, don't let him be crazy. Well, speaking of warning labels, okay, so we're in the horror and not horror section again today. And, horrors was last week. So today we're talking four murder mystery plays, okay? And we've got a guy that wrote it, and so we're going to find out why. So Mr. David Michael Kemp, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we'll see. We'll see how happy you are at the end.
I guess we will.
I'm known to be a little bit. So, listen, I see this as like a, this is a book of, I guess, four stories, basically.
Correct, yes. They're short plays. They're like 10-minute one-acts. They're four one-acts, but they kind of put a longer play if you sort of put them all together. They have, like, the same detective character in all four.
So why, first of all, why are you writing it like a play? Like, what's the idea behind this?
I liked some of the stuff that you got to see, like in live theater, that was just more fun to see, you know, with people actually acting it out as opposed to just watching it like in a short movie or something like that. Like, I love the movie Death Trap. It's one of my favorite movies. But to actually see it live with the thunder and the lightning and like live people walking around and you feel like somebody's actually getting murdered in front of you. I think the experience is just more intense with live actors as opposed to film.
Yeah. Well, you've written, I guess, several short stories. It looks like you said 50 short stories or over 50. And when you get into this, is it a different process writing it like a play? Like how do you picture that in your mind when you're putting it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's a good question. You need different kinds of editors. Now, this is the part where I can actually talk about my editors. One of my editors is my cousin, Heather Slowacki, who also does my book covers, and I think she does an amazing job. She started her own publishing house called Grayland Press. She's worked with some fairly notable people, and she just does a wonderful job. And she's also written three murder mystery books of her own. They're called the Element series. Element Mystery Series, Element of Secrecy, Element of Danger, and Element of Truth. And she's much more, I think, aligned with maybe some of the stuff that you might like, Alan, just like the murder mystery in like its purest sense without any of the the graphic horror, I'm assuming. As far as the plays go, I knew I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I knew I was going to have fun. I knew, you know, it was just like a new experience writing plays. Because I was an English major, I read a lot of plays. And I won an award in college about my paper about Arthur Miller's The Crucible, and I took a seminar on Arthur Miller. So I liked the whole process. But I ended up hiring this lady, Colette Friedman, who has had plays produced all over the world. And even though, you know, the changes were subtle that she made, the world of difference was just incredible. Like, yeah. I thought that there was no limited budget on my play. You know, we could change sets 5 times for a 10-minute play. You know, it's ridiculous. Yeah. But she kept it simple so that, you know, it could actually be done. Like, really be done in the practical sense. Keeping it to one set and keeping the number of characters to what was really necessary for the plot, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. So, Dale, what's the premise behind this? When you say four murder mystery plays, and you talk about alcoholism as a serious problem, and you could, and again, so is murder. Well, I don't see a problem with it, but murder, that is. But let's talk about the premise. Like, what does it mean to you?
Well, I wanted to not just have plays that were focusing on murder mystery elements, but also, you know, I'm a person in recovery. I'm an alcoholic, and I haven't had a drink in 6.5 years. And first of all, I had to get past the nonsense that, you know, to be a great writer, you must be drunk all the time. There have been great writers who've been drunks, and there have been drunks who thought they were great writers, you know. I think it's irrelevant. I think, you know, we were talking about Truman Capote a little while ago. I totally agree with him when he said that you're either a writer or you're not.
Yeah.
I really believe that.
Yeah, yeah. And not only that, I think when you get into that, it's you're a writer or not. So when you're drinking and you're writing, or when you're not drinking and you're writing, you're still writing. It represents who you are at the time. So, you know, I don't think one means the other personally, but.
Well, no, I agree with that. I thought that altering your mind is what made one great, quote unquote. And I would, you know, just put on like a bunch of old movies, things that I've seen before, like Risky Business 100 times, something that I wouldn't pay too much attention to is background noise. But I think that the way that I do it now, you know, I read a lot more, I take in more, and I can really concentrate on the story structure in my novels and my plays and my short stories. And the other thing too is the humility of being sober makes your mind more open to actually listening to the criticisms of your editor. You know, when I was drinking, I'm not even sure why I hired an editor.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, there's, but you know, the editor themselves, if you find someone that you connect with that's good, it'll turn out good. I mean, they're there to make the book better. So for them to ask questions is it's a good thing, you know, and if they get too pushy, then you just push them down the stairs or something. I don't know.
I've been dealing with my cousin as an editor, and we get along very well, but also he used to be a Bucks County guy now. He moved to North Carolina. His name is Al Siroys. He wrote some really great books. One was called Silly Ghouls. One was called The Bohemian Magician. And his wife is also a writer. She just published her first novel, Visible Signs. And Al is just a terrific editor. Again, similar to Colette Friedman. Just like sometimes you need a second set of eyes to you miss things in your own work, and you know the advice is to just put things aside, and then when you come back, say after you had your first or second draft, like 2 or 3 months later, and you read it, it's almost like somebody else wrote it.
Yeah.
And you can read it with fresh eyes. Yeah. You know, you guys are writers. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah, it happens all the time. You know.
It was also this stuff was inspired by my love for Edgar Allan Poe, and I would say my intense fandom of Brian De Palma's movies, his early movies like Dress to Kill and Blowout and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. So your gruff detective that you've got in the center of the place. How does someone like that get created in your mind? Is this something that you just develop in imagination, or you dream about it? Do you hear this character? Do you see him? Like, how does this all work for you?
That's a good question, Alan. Well, I'll tell you, this is what's funny is, you know, it's no secret that addicts and alcoholics have had problems with law enforcement. I don't think I need to point that out too much. So some of my friends in the 12 steps have accused me of being a little harsh on the police in my books. And I actually befriended a homicide detective, a retired homicide detective in AA. And, you know, I got to talk and stuff like that with him. And, you know, the stuff he's been through is entirely horrific. I can kind of see how somebody in that line of work, seeing people at their worst, might end up, you know, turning to alter their mind.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It was a combination of meeting him with, you know, I loved the silly detectives like Peter Sellers, you know, as Clouseau, and I love Columbo. But I also liked some of the more serious detectives. I liked, you know, because Edgar Allan Poe is the father of the detective story with Dupin. Basically, I made the gruff detective a relative of the quote-unquote real Dupin, just to get like the Edgar Allan Poe thing in. And that kind of made it, you know, so that it could be more fun and easier to write for me.
What is your process? Like, do you, because, okay, so not to get too weird, but a lot of writers over the years that we've talked to will describe their characters as, you know, family or friends, or they'd have this description of characters like their personal people they know. Is that your, is it same for you in your case?
Yeah, I think so. But at the same time, I think it's also, I do an awful lot of nods, a lot of homage stuff to things that have inspired me when I was younger. And of course, as I'm sure you guys know, every character is kind of you a little bit, as you probably already know since you're writers. There's a little bit of you in all the characters.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, how much of you do you want to put in something like this? I ask this not only because of something I ask a lot of people, but you've got, you know, you're a recovering alcoholic or addict, and so you're writing with alcoholism as one of your serious problems. So are you comfortable, or you're able to expose your feelings or some of the things that you went through in order to pull this stuff off? I mean, and I mean that in the way of, you know, today's world, everybody and their dog can find you. Like, you're all over, you know, social media and your books and stuff. So you're kind of being a little bit vulnerable by exposing these things about yourself. Is that an issue for you, or are you nervous about that?
No, I'm like a very private person. So if people can think whenever they want. I wanted to also write these plays. I mean, I did like a bunch of play contests. The best I got, mixed reviews from theater directors. The best I did was I got runner-up. I was a semi-finalist in one play contest, and that's the best I did out of all the play contests that I entered. But what I would actually like to see is maybe these plays being produced maybe at rehabs. You know, they have, even, you know, after people have been in detox and rehab long enough, they try to have occupational, creative things, arts to occupy their time. I think putting on a play about recovery in a recovery center would be a very interesting experience for the people that were going to rehab.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an interesting idea. You know, if you're runner-up, if you want to win, you got to sleep with more people.
I'll keep that in mind for next time.
Well, yeah, anytime I need something, I sleep with them, and then I'm there. It seems to work.
Yeah, that's how Warren Beatty got to the top, I guess.
Oh, you no doubt. I'd do anything for him if you want to sleep with me.
I'm just really sure my age. I can see the millennials. Warren, why? Who?
Yeah, who is that?
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering what draws you to the short form. You know, I know you've written novels, short stories, and plays. Do you consider yourself a natural short story writer?
whatever the muse drives me towards, I guess. I really became obsessed with writing 10-minute plays for some reason, and then I did that. And I have to say, it's much harder than people think that it is. When I wrote my first novel, I was just, the problem was that, you know, I had a bunch of friends. We drank together and got drunk. We were all going to be writers, yet none of us ever wrote anything.
Yep.
And of course, I mean, I'm not counting municipal stories from my small town newspaper. Although technically that's professional writing because the checks didn't bounce, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
I got to a certain point, I was like pushing 40 and I wanted to write my first novel. And I made myself do it and I'm really glad that I did. And now I've just finished the third book, you know, in that trilogy. So, it's more hard work than inspiration, but you need the inspiration to be able to do the hard work. And, you know, every character kind of works itself out. If I thought that the detective character should be in a novel, you know, which I still might do, you know, I would have done it that way. But it's the feeling that everything is sort of writing itself. You're just sort of, the story is channeling itself through you and you're just typing. I know you guys know what that's like.
Hmm. Well, do your characters ever surprise you? Do they kind of take over the plot, or do you feel like you're in control?
Most of the time, I'm in control. A few of them have surprised me and gotten out of control, and they were more resilient than I thought, and they survived. I do seek inspiration from real life events, but a lot of the stuff goes back to my childhood. I still remember watching Salem's Lot when I was a little kid in 1979 with my grandparents, and everybody remembers the little boy scratching on the door floating through the air. And I was like, wow, I wish I could scare people like that. Now, I'm pretty sure I slept, you know, in the same bed as my grandparents that night. But
absolutely.
It was absolutely
scary,
terrifying.
Scene.
But I knew I wanted to write when I stole my aunt's copy of Peter Benchley's Jaws when I was little. Mm. I was like, you know, reading it in secret. I was like, oh, this is so exciting. The killer shark. Brody's wife having the affair with Hooper.
Yep.
I was like, I'm going to write about giant sharks and Chief Brody's slutty wife someday. Jaws is my favorite movie of all time, incidentally.
To you, what makes a good story? Like, what elements do you look for?
Well, I suppose I'm not going to say that it have to be profound or something like that, because obviously everybody's not Hemingway or Shakespeare. But I think if it becomes like a true distraction where you can forget about the mundaneness of life for a little while and it really, really takes you away, really sucks you in, the way that Salem's Lot, the book, did to me, actually, after I watched the series years later. Just, you know, Interview with a Vampire did that for me. Peter Straub's Ghost Story did that for me. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Mayberry's Patient Zero did that for me. William F. Nolan's Logan's Run did that for me. So there's certain books that do that. Short stories can do it too, I think. And I remember when I was in college, and the first time I read Clive Barker's short stories, the only thing I knew was Stephen King saying, I've seen the future of horror, it's Clive Barker. And I was a big King fan, so I gave him a try. And holy cow, man, those were like the best short stories I ever read.
The Books of Blood.
Yes. Thank you, Books of Blood. Yeah, I mean, the only thing I did think was the nerve of him to try to write a sequel to an Edgar Allan Poe story, New Murders in the Rue Morgue, but it was really... But it was really good. And he was like turning the genre stuff, just turning it upside down. Because let's face it, there are a lot of stale ideas, you know, stuff that's been done.
Well, it's hard to be original when there's so much out there too, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if I'm original or not. I knew that when I was writing my first novel, I knew that I mean, there's vampires, werewolves, witches. God knows we have enough zombies now, don't we? It's like, what's like a monster that isn't used that much? in a horror novel or books or movies, you know. And then I remember when I was a kid and I read The Arabian Nights, I was like, I want to write about the djinn. I want to write about these genies, you know, try to manipulate us and try to get us to, you know, very similar to the real leprechauns in Irish folklore, try to get us to mess up by, you know, wording our desires or wishes the wrong way. So, you know, I read The Arabian Nights, watched the movie Wishmaster again, read parts of the Quran, and lo and behold, my first novel was about evil genies.
You know, when you write a book, and like even this newer one you've got out, this Four Murder Mystery Place, when someone takes that and reads it, is there something you're hoping they take away from that besides the entertainment part?
Such a good question. Well, besides being entertained, I suppose I hope that they learn that we're kind of all in this together, that we're all the same, meaning human beings, you know, maybe to take it easy and not judge people so harshly, which I know is hard. I know is hard because we frequently don't get our way. You know, you might have thought that Mrs. Shields should have given you a B instead of a C in third grade. I don't know. And much more serious things than that. But yeah, it's, I try to sort of like a sense of connectiveness, I guess, is something that I aspire for readers to feel.
Yeah. Well, that teacher in second grade, she got hers.
Oh, yeah, I had her head cut off by a lion in my second. I'm just kidding.
No, okay, well, now we're getting into the real stuff.
Exactly. I want it where the readers are in on the joke, but the characters aren't. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a form of suspense in a way, because the readers know what can happen or what's going on, but the characters don't all know, so...
And you see that in movies, too. You know, it's almost like you're one of the Greek gods. You already know what their fate's going to be. You know?
Yeah.
I feel that every time I watch the movie Seven. After you watch it the first time, you're like, yeah, now I know what's in the box now. It's not going to shock me anymore.
It's a chocolate cake. Well, you know... when you finish a book, something like this, that has a lot of you in it and a lot of things you've dealt with in your life, and you complete the book and you look back at it, it's out now. How do you think that's changed you?
Well, it's a sense of accomplishment that I've done that. I feel a very similar sense of accomplishment. This is not too strange for you guys, I think, when I get blurbs from people that I admire, and they, you know, they've enjoyed, you know, the work that I've done. You know, I was very pleased with the blurbs that I got for Four Murder Mystery Plays. You know, just some great people there.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan I'm a big fan of Nicholas Grabowski, for example. I think he's great. And you know, it's a small world. Clive Barker's a big fan of Nicholas Grabowski. I'm a big fan of Nicholas Grabowski. And I just think that his work is, it's written in a way that it's like this unique style. I can't put it into words. But I've had blurbs from people that have just blown me away, like Jonathan Mayberry and Gary Razor and this lady, Meredith Bogart Brown, who wrote for Heavy Metal Magazine, I'm a big fan of. This actress, Lorraine Evanoff. This new kid, Natasha Sinclair. This actor, George Stover, from B-horror movies and John Waters movies. You know, he really liked my play about the laundry room. That was pretty cool. I grew up watching these low-budget movies, too. Do you guys know who Don Doler was?
Oh, no, I don't. Dave, no. I don't. I don't.
He was a low, and I mean low, budget horror movie maker, and I found that so inspiring that he didn't have to go to Hollywood. You know, he just made movies right there in Maryland in his home. And George, you know, being an actor there, for example, he worked for the only two, I mean, I shouldn't say the only two, but the two primary movie directors and Maryland were John Waters and Don Doler. So that's who George frequently worked with. And, you know, I like the Midnight Cult movies a lot. So it was pretty cool when he liked something that I wrote. Murder mystery set in a laundry room. That is definitely, you know, you could do that low budget, I think.
You kind of have a point to it, but right? Like when you say that, you're kind of meaning that I think you're trying to bring up the point of how alcoholism can really screw up your life.
Oh, it's a tragedy, man. I'm not going to say my sponsor's name, obviously, but he probably, oh my gosh, he was just a genius IQ and an engineer. He probably could have ended up being just incredibly successful. He's doing pretty well now because he hasn't had to drink in 15 years, but he just threw a lot of his life. He ended up being homeless. Here's this guy with a genius IQ, and he ends up being homeless. It's unbelievable. So, yeah, it definitely can ravage your life.
Yeah.
You know, and I can say in all seriousness that it is a devastating problem that you have to do something about. And I do think there's more than one way to get sober. I think you can get sober in other ways besides AA, but I do believe the program helps a lot of people.
Yeah, it sure seems to, you know. So where do you see yourself going next, now that this book's out? Where do you see yourself doing with writing here?
Well, I'm finishing up on my new novel, and I think, you know, that's going to be good to take all the characters from Dark Fiction and Damned Fiction and finally put an end, you know, to the story. I do try to get people to think about addiction and what a terrible problem that it is. I mean, I guess, I don't know if you guys saw that I wrote a children's book about addiction with my son when he was 8, and I'm very proud of that. There's not too many, you know, children's books about addiction. It's kind of a, you know, grim fairy tale, dark subject, I guess, for a children's book, but I think we did a good job with it. And, you know, I did a novel, They Laughed at Me, which was about a recovering alcoholic on house arrest who moonlights as a comedian, even though he has an ankle bracelet on. And there's various references to alcoholism in my short stories. And obviously, as you guys know, the plays are very thematic and filled with the horrors of addiction, and particularly in rehab, the horrors of withdrawal. With, you know, watching people go through withdrawal is terrible, particularly alcohol withdrawal. Alcohol withdrawal, heroin withdrawal, you would think would be worse, but even though they feel like crap and they feel horrible and hellish, they're still going to live. You can genuinely die of a heart attack or a stroke going through alcohol withdrawal, and it's an ugly thing to have to see.
Hmm. Yeah.
Even worse to experience, I might add.
No, I could imagine. How long does it take someone to recover from something like that? Withdrawal.
Genuinely, 48 hours, you're pretty much in the clear.
Yeah. You have to take drugs to kind of stop getting the shakes?
Yeah, they typically value in benzos to keep people from having a stroke or heart attack. They give people stuff. I mean, I don't know the exact stuff they give, but, you know, it's extremely dangerous if you're at the end stages, Alan, where you're drinking on an empty stomach and you're not eating and you're not sleeping and you've lost a lot of weight and you don't know what the hell's going on, and then to just stop. It's extremely dangerous.
Hmm. Yeah, I could imagine that would be a terrible thing to go through. So social media and all that. So do you have a website or a place that people can come find you?
Well, the stuff is listed for Masters of R. I usually just go right to my Amazon page. I did have a website. It's down right now. I'm going to have my cousin probably design me an all-new website.
Okay. So how was the writing over the last little while for you with COVID and all the weird stuff going on? Does that affect you, or just things going on in your life, I guess, is kind of really a question. You know, I mean, of course it affects you, but do you find that it interferes with your writing itself?
I'd hate to say it. It was actually kind of a hidden blessing.
Okay. No.
But yeah, I mean, to be alone and to be able to just, you know, because I live alone, just to be able to just have all that, you know, isolation and privacy, I guess. You know, I feel now like, you know, I'm 54 years old. I feel like there's just not enough hours in the day to get done what I want. And, you know, even though it was unpleasant and scary for all of us, the pandemic, and it's particularly hard to explain to children, you know, my son or my niece, my nephew, whatever, the time that you got, that I got to, you know, to try to put some of these ideas out, you know, it was pretty cool, actually. I mean, I'm sorry for the COVID outbreak, and I wish I could tell you that it was horrifying,
no.
But it was actually sort of creative and productive, quite
yeah,
honestly.
Yeah, no, I get both responses. Some people find it really, it's been good for them and helps them get away and be creative, and other people, well, shuts them down, stresses them out, and they can't function very well or write very well. So it's kind of, you kind of get both. So, yeah, that's interesting.
Also an amateur magician here. I'm getting my magic stuff together to do some shows in the summer. My town's carnival usually has my son and I doing a magic show. So it's just us and a clown, pretty much, is the entertainment.
Wow.
I'm not going to say the clown's
Gacy?
Name.
Is it Gacy?
No.
William Gacy, the clown?
It's Amber. It's Amber something. I can't remember.
Amber Turd.
Yeah, well, you know, the people usually get into it. It's funny. I feel like I'm in the middle of a Ray Bradbury story, you know.
No, it's good.
And you know, the movie Magic is one of my favorite movies of all time. I don't know if you guys saw that, the one with Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, actually. That's really good.
The book is even better.
The book is always better.
Actually. Actually, even though I love the book Jaws, I'd have to say that the movie's better. I also think the movie The Shining's better than the book.
I agree.
But in general, you're definitely correct. Yeah. You're absolutely, definitely correct.
Well,
So I just wanted to throw, I guess, I wanted to thank Jeff Oliver for connecting me to you guys. I wanted to thank my friend Tamara Thorne for the blurbs for the first play. And I'd like to give a shout out to my friend Michael Baker, who makes his own homemade magic tricks, stuff that is just, you know, incredible. I mean, I like some of these cell phone effects for magic and things like that, but that the old world artist, craftsman that he is, his magic tricks are incredible. Like, even if you just want to collect the stuff as art. Because as I'm speaking to you guys, I'm just looking around and I have more magic tricks than I know what to do with. I don't, it's a replacement addiction, I think. I can't stop buying them.
Well, as you can keep affording them. I mean, going out stealing.
Their commercials work really well on me in my mind. Yes, it's expensive, but do you want to just be some amateur magician, or do you want to be the real deal? And I'm kind of like, well, I want to be the real deal.
Just add water. It works.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I guess I could do some ventriloquism over the radio for you guys. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, on that note, well, it's been an interesting conversation, and we're going to wrap it up today, and we appreciate you coming by. Now, your latest book is called Four Murder Mystery Plays. Of course, our guest is the writer of that, Mr. David Michael Kemp. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun, guys.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, all shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.